Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 289, Black Velvet Opskop, a De Beers Trojan Horse, and Kimberley's Multiracial Minor Protest. It could be said that Cecil Rhodes' quest for hegemony over the diamond industry of South Africa was quickened by rumours of significant gold discoveries in the Transvaal. Others say no, because no one was aware in these heady days of just how valuable the motherlode of Main Reef was to become. Just a quick note. The easy way to picture Kimberley in 1886 and 87 is not a collection of neatly separated modern mining companies, each with its own mine. It was more like a gigantic underground chessboard where the four great diamond mines around Kimberley, De Beers, Kimberley, De Toitspan, Bultfontein, had originally been divided into hundreds of individual claims. A claim was essentially a small piece of ground, and in the early days an individual digger or small partnership could own one or several of these. As the workings became deeper and more dangerous, these little claims were progressively bundled together into larger holdings and companies. By the mid-1880s, therefore, you had companies that owned groups of claims inside a particular mine, while the word mine referred to the entire diamond-bearing pipe or the working area. So, if you were standing in Kimberley in 1886 and somebody said, "I'm working in the Kimberley mine," that did not necessarily mean he or she worked for a company called Kimberley Mine. He may have worked for Kimberley Central, or the French company, or Standard, or one of the smaller interests that still held claims there. The mine was the physical hole in the ground. The companies were the owners of pieces of that hole. In 1886-87, the whole industry was therefore in the middle of a gigantic transition from hundreds of little claim holders hacking away independently at the diamond-bearing ground toward a handful of enormous corporations controlling entire mines. Underground mining was replacing the enormous open pits because the old workings were becoming dangerously deep. Companies were sinking shafts and driving tunnels down into the pipes. At the same time, Cecil John Rhodes and Barney Bonato were consolidating ownership above ground. By 1886, Rhodes wasn't powerful enough to overcome other significant owners in Kimberley, although most of the other entrepreneurs believed amalgamation was good for diamonds. No one wanted to be dominated by Rhodes or each other, and Rhodes was seeking domination. While the majority of those in Kimberley scrabbled and scratched, the magnates were high in the hog. They frequented the Kimberley Club, launched by 74 well-heeled citizens, WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, who pledged £100 each, a double-story structure that impressed as it rose from the flat Griqualand surrounds. Evenings were full of dinners and dances, and black tie and evening dress abounded, awash in the blaze of the new electric lights, the first in South Africa, which twinkled inside the homes of the rich and splashed along the streets. Men and women mingled, thronged, and thrusted. The tuxedo-dressed elite sat in their plush chairs inside the Kimberley Club, pressing the electric bells to call waiters who slid effortlessly across the plush velvet pile and Turkish carpets. Most evenings, sitting side by side in the lounge, were Cecil John Rhodes and his friend and co-shareholder Alfred Beit, sipping on their favourite tipple, which was black velvet, a mixture of champagne and stout beer, suitably fortified. They would dance, but let me hasten to add, not together. Rhodes, with the plainest girl available, apparently, while Beit, who was a short man, often sought out the tallest woman. A weird vaudeville show, and watched by a few of the sober enough to register the irony. Beit, in many ways, should eclipse Rhodes in the pantheon of early colonial powerhouses. Without him, Rhodes would have probably found it far more difficult to launch his multifold plans. Born in Hamburg, Germany, Alfred Beit was the eldest son and the second of six children of an affluent Jewish family who disappointed his mum and dad in his studies and was promptly sent off to apprentice as Jules Porge and Co. in Amsterdam. They were in the diamond business, and soon young Alfred had made a name for himself, developing a rare talent for examining precious stones. At age 22, Beit was sent to Kimberley, and that was in 1875, by Jules Porge and Co. to buy diamonds. Recognizing the desperate demand for office space and secure business premises in the booming, chaotic mining camp, he bought a piece of ground in Kimberley, erected 12 corrugated iron sheds and shacks, kept one for his own operations, and then rented out the remaining 11. When he eventually sold the property in the late 1880s, he scored a substantial profit. He developed a close relationship with Cecil Rhodes, and the evening black velvet romps became the stuff of legend. Rhodes was to be appointed chairman of De Beers in 1886, and he accelerated the competition with Kimberley's Central Mine to take control of all operations in their respective small amounts, then become the first company to assert dominance over the whole sector. Seconds out, as they say. De Beers appeared to be in a better position than Kimberley's Central because Rhodes was able to deploy cheap labour, having secured a deal with the Cape government to use convicts. Geology had also dealt De Beers a second advantage because Kimberley's Central suffered from reef problems, coughing up vast amounts to pay for the clearance of falling rock. The third advantage was De Beers' mine had stored more diamondiferous ore stock, which gave it a stronger bargaining position when negotiating with investors. But Kimberley Central could claim they'd been around longer. However, as everyone knows in business, being first doesn't guarantee success. Bonato tried to compete with De Beers, but things were moving fast, and Rhodes' company was ahead in the race, absorbing smaller miners. Then in May 1887, bought Victoria Company, which had been operating within De Beers' mine. Alfred Beit was the key to what happened next because he had already drawn the attention of one of the most powerful capitalists in the world, Nathaniel Natty Rothschild of Rothschild's Bank in London. Beit wrote a letter of introduction for Rhodes, who sailed off to England, where he met Natty Rothschild. The first meeting didn't start well. Rothschild was frosty, faced by a colonial Rhodes with his sunburned face and somewhat rough around the edges look. But Natty understood money and realized what Rhodes was on about. Someone had to control the flow of diamonds, and that meant a monopoly. For an amalgamation scheme to work, one man would have to sit at the top of the pyramid of diamond companies, either Barney Bonato or Cecil Rhodes. Both were eyeing the one major company left by 1887, called the French Company, that was based inside the Kimberley mine. Actually, its full name was the Compagnie Française des Mines des Diamants du Cap de Bonne Espérance, French Company of the Diamond Mines of the Cape of Good Hope. By its firm, Jules Porges & Co., already had deep ties to Paris banking circles, but they needed an extraordinary amount of sterling to secure the deal. Rhodes had to borrow more than £1 million. As the first meeting with Rothschild ended in London, Natty said, "Well, Mr. Rhodes, you go to Paris and see what you can do in reference to the purchase of the French company's property, and in the meantime, I will see if I can raise the £1 million which you desire." A few weeks later, Rhodes was back in South Africa, and he'd pulled off a business coup d'etat. The French company was amenable to a sale, and Rhodes believed he had what he called the Kimberley crowd by the throat, because the Rothschilds Bank had lent him £1.3 million. Rhodes then offered French mines £1.4 million, thinking that was more than enough to seal the deal. Barney Bonato, however, was not part of the throat-gripped crowd. He owned 20% of the French company shares and had his own plan to do some throat-grabbing. Bonato offered the French company £1.7 million. When he heard about this, Rhodes told Bonato, "You can go and offer £300,000 more than we do for the French, but we will offer another £300,000 on top of that. You can go on and bid for the benefit of the French shareholders ad infinitum, because we shall have it in the end." Rhodes was happily dealing with other people's money. Barney Bonato was not. He was using his own cash, his own debt. Rhodes then pulled another fast one in mid-1887, apparently surrendering, suggesting that De Beers would buy the French company outright and then sell it to Bonato's Central Company for the total price of 300,000 cash plus 70,000 Central shares. It was an apparent win-win. Rhodes would save face, Bonato would save money, and to onlookers, Barney had triumphed. He was the proud new owner of most of the Central shares and all of the French. Job done, success. Except no, it was a classic case of a Trojan horse deal. What Rhodes had done is approached Beit's old bosses at Jules Porges and Company and asked them to secretly buy up shares in Victoria Mine, one of Kimberley's Central Mines, that was Bonato's mines, funded by De Beers with money lent by Rothschild's Bank. De Beers spent £57,000 and picked up 3,000 shares. Rhodes' partner Alfred Beit bought another 3,000, and now De Beers owned one-fifth of Barney Bonato's central company. It didn't take long for the coup to pan out. In April 1887, Rhodes announced De Beers was the largest shareholder in the Victoria Company, which had decided it was time to amalgamate with De Beers. Bada bing. Meanwhile, back at the Bonato Ranch, Kimberley Central's amalgamation plans were also steaming ahead, despite the fact that it was building up considerable debt. Rhodes had traded his way into Barney's territory, and now he showed his teeth. Brokers were beckoned hither and told to bid on the Central's outstanding shares. But now it would take a massive £2 million to buy them all. "Ask little Alfred," became Rhodes' refrain. Bite was his problem solver and his financial backer. And Bite knew a good thing when he saw it, joining hands with Cecil once more, at least financially. In February 1888, Central shares cost £14 on the London Stock Exchange. But Barney Bonato had trusted his existing shareholders. He called them his friends. He trusted them to stave off any approach. Money, of course, creates its own loyalties, and there is no honour when greed is the motive. At least Rhodes was blunt and told Bonato to his face in front of witnesses that,
"I'll tell you what you'll find presently. Here you have your leading shareholders patting you on the back and backing you up, but selling out around the corner all the time."
By March 1888, Kimberley Central mining shares were trading at £20 instead of 14, then 30, then 40, and eventually Bonato's so-called friends balked at the money they could make and sold to Rhodes. By the end of the month, he controlled three-fifths of Central Mine. Bonato was not easily vanquished. He fought to the end and announced an outrageous plan. He would take the two-fifths of shares left, consolidate them, and then make these minority shares into a public company all by themselves, and then sell the shares on the London Stock Exchange at £1 a share. That was almost suicidal, because all of Kimberley Central shares would then be devalued, not to mention other shares of mines around Griquill and West. Rhodes wasn't sure if Barney was bluffing, so he developed a conspiracy so cunning and wicked, it's hard to believe, but it's true, folks, and has gone down in financial lore as the historic trick. Rhodes began circulating stories he was skint, running out of cash, and to raise money he would sell De Beers surplus diamonds. Now it was Barney Bonato's turn to do a double take, but the lure of owning such a treasure trove was too much. To the astonishment of Kimberley, the deal went through when Barney agreed to pay Rhodes his price for these surplus diamonds. Rhodes had apparently allowed his arch rival access to enough stones to dilute the value of the entire diamond trade worldwide. Barney duly came around to pick up his diamonds, which had been laid out on suede on a stand under Kimberley's electric lights. As Bonato ogled his new treasure, Rhodes pulled a stunt, which has been called both childish and churlish, but definitely historic. Cecil suddenly grabbed the edge of the stand and poured all the diamonds into a single large bucket. It was going to take Barney Bonato's experts 6 weeks to resort the diamonds into their proper classes. This gave the European market a breathing spell. Later, Bonato would respond magnanimously to the moment, saying it didn't matter much, when of course it did. Many historians believe the entire incident was stage-managed by both. Who really knows? Certainly, these two diamond madmen had done everything in the run-up to the moment except sell tickets. It would take 48 hours virtually on the trot for four men to hammer out the final agreement inside the cottage owned by Dr. Jameson for the ownership of diamonds in Kimberley. Cecil John Rhodes, Alfred Bite, Barney Bonato, and Barney's nephew, Wolf Joel. There were arguments, voices were raised, fists were curled, expletives, and in the midst, Rhodes holding court. He spoke of using the power they'd have to control the diamond industry and, by extension, Africa. The entire continent could be managed in the same way, said the imperialist, to which Wolf Joel said,
"Aren't those just dreams of the future? Dreams don't pay dividends."
"No, my friend," said Rhodes. "They're not dreams. They're plans. There's a difference."
Profound words. The entire southern African region, perhaps the entire continent of Africa and beyond, was going to be shaped by these plans. But give him credit, Bonato didn't budge. At least at first. Rhodes threw everything at him. He needed the entire Kimberley Central Company. Without amalgamation with De Beers, his master plan would not work. Rhodes promised Barnato he'd make him a member of the prestigious Kimberley Club, where black velvet awaited, along with short and tall women with which to dance.
"I'll make a gentleman out of you," said Rhodes.
This referred to Barnato being Jewish, and Rhodes was intimating that Barney would become the first Jewish member of the snobbish club of WASPs. This wasn't true. There were already Jewish members. But Rhodes was dangling the idea. Still, Barney said no. Rhodes guaranteed a life directorship of De Beers and claimed it was worth
as much as the balance of Africa.
Barney said no. Rhodes promised Barney a seat in the Cape Legislative Assembly, and Barney said no. At 4 the next morning, Barney Barnato finally wilted, saying philosophically,
"Some people have a fancy for this thing and for some that, and you have a fancy for making an empire. Well, I suppose I must give it to you."
Folks, there's been much myth-making around this meeting, these hours where the entire future of a subcontinent was negotiated by 4 capitalists. Many have distorted this moment, and the legend has worked its way into history books. However, there is a truth here about Barney Barnato. Remember, he'd changed his name from Isaacs and used Barney as a form of the name Barnum Bailey, a showman of the era. So Barney Barnato was an actor, a posturer, a frowner, devious, menacing, finally capitulating. Kimberley Central minority shareholders were stunned and shocked. Rhodes targeted the smaller mines at Bultfontein and De Toey Spun, while the central shareholders planned a legal response. A group of these minority stockholders appeared before the Supreme Court of the Cape Colony in August 1888 contesting the deal. Rhodes put forward his defense that he had plans to trade in precious stones and metals, to construct railways and factories, canals even, banks, and to buy vast tracts of what he called country, and to pacify and administrate territories where, he said, arrangements could be made with black chiefs. Central stockholders proved that De Beers had no intention of remaining a diamond company, but that Rhodes planned a dangerous extension of business that threatened the operations. Rhodes's lawyer told the Supreme Court justices that De Beers can do anything and everything. Since the name of the East India Company, no company has had such power as this. If they obtain a charter in accordance with their trust deed from the Secretary of State, they would be empowered to annex a portion of territory in Central Africa and raise and maintain a standing army and undertake warlike operations. Which is precisely what they were going to do. Still, the judge ruled in the favor of the minority shareholders, but Rhodes had one more devious card to play. Just as the Central Company dissidents were congratulating themselves on winning the case, Rhodes put Central into voluntary liquidation. De Beers then picked up the pieces, and the minority shareholders were helpless. On January 29th, 1889, the Central Mine was formally put to sleep, as Stefan Kampfer writes in his book, Last Empire. De Beers bought its assets for £5,338,650, the biggest check written anywhere in the world up until then. The amount dazzled the world. For years, tourists bought replicas of the check in souvenir shops, and the original check hung on the wall of the De Beers boardroom. Howls of opposition rose in South Africa and Britain. The press in England called it a sellout of shareholders, unethical, which indeed it was. But of all those involved, Barney Barnato appeared to enjoy the moment most. He then campaigned for a seat in the Cape Legislature, dressed in a silver-grey coat with bright purple lapels and a grey top hat, driven everywhere in a gilded carriage, drawn by 4 dappled horses and accompanied by riders dressed in gold lace and jockey caps. A little Trumpian. Cape politicians were horrified. This showman, with his fixation on gold and fluff, was a disgrace, they said. And suddenly, in a moment, those who were most affected acted. These were black and white mine workers, the labourers. After the Central's shut down, Rhodes fired most of the labourers. They were unnecessary to his aims. He could trim his payroll still further by getting rid of these men. They were expendable. And so, as we end this episode, please imagine this scene, replete as it was with symbolism and deep irony. A group of white miners, joined by black miners, playing guitars, as they marched from Detoy Spun Mine into Kimberley. There, outside the Kimberley Club, they burned an effigy of Rhodes, and one of the protesters read a dedication.
"We will now commit to the flames the last mortal remains of Cecil John Rhodes, Amalgamated General, Diamond King, and Monarch of De Beers. And in doing so, let us not forget to give three cheers for a traitor to his adopted country, a panderer to the selfish greed of a few purse-proud speculators, and a public pest. May the Lord perish him. Amen."
Protests continued in Detoy Spun and Kimberley. More effigies of Barney Monato and Alfred Bite and Rhodes were burned, but it was all futile. Most protesters wore masks, so wary were they of the power of these men, the power of the money they wielded. A new kind of political muscle had emerged in South Africa. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. You can sign up for the newsletter at desmondlatham.blog. Until next, tot ziens.